Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Manufacturing was New Hampshire's economic king in the 1950s, when half of all employment involved making something, shoes, textiles, machinery, and so forth. And that dominance continued for a long time, but 20 to 30 years ago, the sector began to see a steady decline due to a variety of factors, and there's been a lot of political and economic angst about the loss of these reliable, well-paying jobs. Now, though, manufacturing is coming back strong, but different. Employers say they have plenty of work, but not the skilled workforce they need. So here in New Hampshire, they're making huge efforts to close that gap, and we're finding out how today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests. Phil Presbyszewski is here. He's with the Workforce Solutions Project. He's the director for the Community College System of New Hampshire. And Phil, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Christine Carr, executive director for the New Hampshire Center, the New Hampshire Career and Technical Educators Association, which is part of the New Hampshire Career and Technical Centers. Christine, it's good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Laura.
And also with us, Sarah Colson, director of Workforce Development at the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association, head of the joint BIA New Hampshire Charitable Foundation's Workforce Accelerator 2025. And Sarah, welcome. Good to see you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, all of you, but I'm going to start with you first, I think, Christine. Manufacturing executives that we've had on this show before, talking about this very issue, have said partly this is due to the fact that manufacturing has what they call an image problem. People think that the jobs are going to go away because they've heard headlines about that for years. Some people think the jobs are sort of really hard labor and dirty and smelly and involve a lot of, you know, scary chemicals. What do you think? Does manufacturing still have an image problem?
You know, depends on who you ask, really, Laura. But in short, from my point of view, you know, where I've been the last sort of 5-10 years, there's some amazing things happening in manufacturing, especially if you look at with the Internet of Things and the way that manufacturing is becoming increasingly connected to devices and sensors. This goes way beyond what happened 30, 40 years ago. And actually, this is not really a new story. This has been going on for the last 10 years. So technology has really impacted manufacturing, and those jobs that are out there today are incredibly exciting, and they present great opportunities for young people.
How much do you think that old image clings?
You know, it depends on what generation you ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've come from a family-owned business, and I've watched my dad establish his machining business, you know, back in 1969, and that was the days of the machine shop, and we did milling and turning, and today, if you look at that business, it's a totally different business. So my brother, who's in my generation now, is looking at that as, let's put some advanced equipment in there. We need young people with computer skills. We need people who can think, but we still need them to understand how to make things.
I'd love your thoughts, too, Phil, on this. You told us just before we went on the air that you worked in manufacturing most of your career.
I worked in manufacturing for a longer period of time than I want to admit right now. But, the old days of dirty, dark, and dangerous, which is what manufacturing used to be called.
Dirty, dark, and dangerous.
Dirty, dark, and dangerous. Your grandfather's manufacturing is no more. Christine just described very well, but in companies today, you could eat off the floor. They're so clean. And the technology changes that have taken place over the years have really made a huge difference, as Christine stated. But it's really made a huge shift in the job skills required, which is part of the challenge that companies have today, is because the skill sets are quite a bit different.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about that. So as you go out and you talk to young people, again, you're working with the community college system, Phil, do some people still think it's dirty, dark, and dangerous?
I think they do. I think particularly maybe the parents do, because they remember their grandfather working in the factory and lost his finger in 1901. And, you know, those stigmas are still out there. But they need to get exposed to what's, you know, what's inside the four walls of a company today. It's totally different. And also a lot of different jobs. A lot of job categories have changed. More technician level skill sets. And all the other jobs that go around a manufacturing company, purchasing, accounting, and, you know, planning. There's a lot of good jobs out there that are available in manufacturing.
So if people want, you know, sexy high tech, you got it. But it's interesting what you just said, and I have heard this from other manufacturing executives as well, Phil, that sometimes the challenge for companies to get young people in isn't the young people, it's the parents, because they remember grandpa's job.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we could talk about this for a couple of days, but
we've got an hour, so that's good.
You know, when I grew up, I got exposed to using my hands, because that's what you, when you went to middle school, used to call it junior high back then, you had to take shop. I don't think it's even, other than the CTE Center today, kids don't get exposed to working with the hands, trying to noodle out a problem, all those great skills that become second nature to us who've lived through it. So they got to get exposed to it, and there's a lot of things going on to make that happen. But the parents, I think, are reluctant to realize the fact that there's really good opportunities there right down the street. And they, you know, maybe they live through a layoff themselves, and they're leery about that for their kids and their children, their generation. So.
Sure, because there's been decades of headlines about, you know, a slide in manufacturing jobs. But as we're hearing no more, Sarah, what do you think about this whole image issue?
You know, when I'm going out and I'm speaking with manufacturers about this, there's definitely a perception on their end that this is still an issue. A lot of the conversations I've been having is about this cultural shift. So when we're talking about getting the parents in and thinking about, you know, manufacturing is a career for their students, for their children, that they should be considering. Right now, we're just wrapping up Manufacturing Month. And so a lot of tours have been happening. Students have been getting in and meeting with manufacturers. One example I'd like to share is over in the Monadnock region just recently, three companies brought in a wave of students. And it was on a Wednesday. All the students kind of came through, took a tour. They did ask the students as they were entering the building, would you be interested in going into manufacturing? And those students at that point, very few of them were interested in it. When they came out after the tour, they asked again, and the kids were very excited and thought, this is a great job, and there are a lot of opportunities here. And so what they've been doing is, after that tour, a week out, they were going to be bringing in the parents. And I have not circled back to hear how that went, but they were very excited to hear what the parents' perception was. I think that the adults in their lives, that the students' lives, don't necessarily know that these opportunities exist and that they're great-paying jobs, that the, you know, it's clean, it's a great experience for the students. They can make a living wage and really be successful.
What was it, do you think, Sarah, that made the kids at the beginning of the tour, and you said they changed their minds after, but at the beginning say, nah, not so much?
Well, and it might just be that they're not, it's a lack of awareness. And I think bringing awareness to these job opportunities is very important. A lot of the conversations that I have with employers is about bringing themselves into the classroom. Getting themselves in front of students, whether that's at the high school level, it could be at the college level, but really high school, middle school, even elementary school, getting the students exposed to just the different types of opportunities that exist.
Well, and I have a question about what you called shop fill and what they call today tech ed and so forth. But just to clarify, Sarah, so how severe is this skilled labor shortage among manufacturers?
Great question. I've gone to a couple of different places where I've actually sat down with an employer and they have slid a piece of paper across to the table to me and said, okay, these are the jobs I'm hiring for. And I have to look at them and say, oh, I'm very, very sorry, but I don't have a trunk full of manufacturers right now. it's a critical shortage right now. And I think that some employers are getting by with the staff that they have and really it affects production. So I think that the numbers that are out there for the positions that are open might not truly be an accurate reflection of the number of positions they would like to hire for.
So maybe not specific numbers, but from what you hear in your travels around the state, it's pretty severe.
Correct.
What are you hearing, Phil?
It's definitely the case. I have some job posting numbers just there fairly recent that said there's like 1,600 jobs open at any one point in time in manufacturing in the state of New Hampshire. And
1,600?
1,600. That's just a snapshot from the middle of the summertime. So that might change over the years. And that's gone up since last year. So we're also seeing you know, there's this roughly 68,000 workers in manufacturing in the state today. That's up about 1.5 to 2% from last year. And I think if you look at the trends over the last 3 to 5 years, you're going to see that there's been an uptick. And you mentioned earlier on, Laura, at the very beginning, that manufacturing is coming back. And it is. A lot of companies who offshore brought stuff, shipped stuff over to Asia, are bringing it back to the U.S. because the cost differential has changed now, because those quality of life in those countries has gone up, so the cost has gone up. But the other thing that's really important to understand is that the types of jobs are different. The grandfather in the factory's job, those jobs don't exist anymore. So what the parents and grandparents used to know is totally different than what reality looks like today.
Well, that is a headline that you mentioned that, again, goes counter to the headlines that we heard, you know, during the recession and a couple years afterwards. All we heard for many years, Phil, is manufacturing jobs on the decline. So it's, again, it's a, if I were a young person, I would think, well, are those jobs still going to be there in 5, 10 years? Should I really jump in with both feet on this?
I think another thing to think about is all the easy stuff, the easy jobs, the mundane, rote, they're over in Asia somewhere or Thailand or someplace like that. The real technically challenging jobs, the good stuff, if you will, still resides. If you look at the cool stuff that's made in New Hampshire, you'd be impressed with aerospace and chocolate and wine and beer and firefighter suits. And it goes on and on and on from there. There's some really nice stuff going on in the state. There's something like 300 companies that are involved in aerospace. So those huge futures in those particular kind of industries. I mean, companies like GE just put a big expansion on their plant a couple of years ago because they got a huge contract for a new engine.
So, how often are you guys hearing, anybody can jump in on this, from companies that, I would like to take this contract. I've got a client. I guess I'll throw this to Sarah. I've got a client. He or she wants me to do this job. I can't do it because I don't have enough workers.
Yeah, I definitely do.
I have
hear
to reject
that.
This contract.
Absolutely. There's a company in the southern part of the state that I had that conversation with earlier this summer, and that was one that literally just listed out here the job openings that I have, and that's kind of looking at the a higher level, so higher engineers, so an additional layer of training for a lot of those high level positions. But really, even at the entry level positions, if you don't have enough employees, it's really difficult for them to take on those contracts.
I want to invite our listeners to join us. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, where is New Hampshire's manufacturing workforce? Companies say they have great jobs, but not enough skilled workers to fill them. We're looking at efforts to change that, and you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. So all of you are working in efforts to bring more young people into this sector. Christine, to you first, because you're working in the schools. What's the pitch? Let's say I'm getting ready to graduate from high school. How do you convince me?
Yeah, that's the challenge right now for so many of us. And there's two answers to that. I mean, the first answer is the work that we're doing in the career and technical education centers. And just for background, there are 80 high schools across the state.
CRTCs, Concord High has one.
Yeah, well, of the 80 high schools, a smaller portion of those are actually career and technical schools, and it's around 25 schools. So all of those schools are really focused on promoting career and technical education, and that's sort of where NHCTE lives. And by the way, if you'd ever want more information on NHCTE, you can go to nh-cte.org, which is a website that tells you where all of these centers are located. But going back to this, you know, what we're talking about, there is sort of two lines of thinking right now. So we have our traditional education, career and tech ed, and we've been offering that for decades. But what's really happening is a much bigger and newer conversation around career education in general. And that really goes beyond what CTEs are offering, and that includes so many other stakeholders in the community. And that's a lot of the work that Sarah is leading.
So tell us a little bit more about that for people who aren't as involved as the three of you. So CTE is career technical education. And just shed a little bit more light, please, on that newer conversation that you just mentioned.
Sure. I think people look at career and technical education still, even though it's changing, as almost like this is where you send your children when you want them to learn a trade or a set of skills. And the changing conversation is more around what can we do with our kids to get them thinking about what they want to do with their lives much earlier? And for us at CTE, that space is the seventh and eighth grade space. It's where we really live, trying to get kids to think about what they're excited about. What makes them, what are they drawn to? What careers are they drawn to? And they don't know yet because they're only in eighth grade. They're only 14, 15 years old. So if we have to have some way to increase the awareness about the programs, and we have to expose them to it. And so many people have come up to me in the last 2 or 3 weeks just saying, well, the reason why kids don't know about it is because, well, their mom or dad, they work in a particular profession. It could be anything. And that's what they're surrounded by, so that's what they know. And so our work in the very near future is to really make sure that we do a much better job at exposing kids at the seventh and eighth grade level so they really know what all the options are. And the board that I work with, which is a tremendous group of people, they're really directors of these schools. In their words, they always say, let's just present great options. Let's give kids options. And if we give them great options, then they can make great decisions about their future.
Options such as, like, you know, the shop classes that Phil mentioned, some of the engineering exposure in tech ed. Is that what you're talking about?
I think what the conversation is about is a commonly used expression, you know, kids don't know what they don't know.
Right.
So starting with that, think about all of the options that are available in career and tech ed, and it ranges. It's not only manufacturing, building and construction, nursing and so forth. Now it's computer engineering and computer science and coding and game design and more, much more. And this is where kids really get engaged. They love it. It's something that makes sense to them. They can relate to it. And if we can give them a little hook early on, and even if they change their mind, that's okay. But it's better than not doing anything. And I just want to say, too, is that it's not just the tech and career high schools who care about this. It's everybody. It's all the high schools. And it goes from kindergarten to post-secondary. There are so many people who care about this problem and who are trying to solve it.
Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that one of the things that we do, or it was done at Manchester Community College, is they have a summer school for kids. They call it Nuts and Bolts and the Thingamajigs. And what they do is they target middle school children, girls and guys. They bring them into the college and they teach them about robotics, mechatronics, how to use machinery. Every day they make something in the lab. And the kids go home and say, look what I made in the lab, Mom and Dad. And at the end of the week, the middle of the week, we take them on a tour. They go to two factories and show them, this is what one looks like. This is what company, that thing you made in the lab, well, this is a bigger version of that. And then the last day of the week, they invite the parents to come in to meet with the professor and the children and talk about their week and how exciting it was. But the whole thing about they getting exposed now to something they never would have had a chance to get exposed to. So, and I remember one story in particular, if I can just put it in here. There was an engineer who brought his son to the class, and at the end of the week, I could see him, they were walking out the front door, and he said, Dad, I want a job just like yours. I want to be an engineer. So, well, we succeeded on that one, right? So we made something become important to that child who never would have been exposed to it otherwise.
So this is a tough question, and we're heading into a break. So I'm going to put it out there, and then you can cogitate during the break. How do you avoid pigeonholing a young person early on, you know, saying to a certain type of child, you're better for technical education, saying to another child, you're better for, a typical 4-year degree? How do you avoid, how do you make sure that it's the right fit for a kid, especially at such a young age? We'll talk about that after a break and a lot more, including what manufacturers might do to reach out to certain groups, veterans, immigrants, and we'll talk about who's responsible for training. All that's coming up, plus your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. The race for the corner office in Manchester is between incumbent Mayor Ted Gatsis.
People know that I'm frugal with the dollar, And I want to make sure that the tax rate doesn't go through the roof and that we abide by the tax cap.
And challenger Joyce Craig.
We have had 8 years of the same person, and we're dealing with the same issues.
I'm Laura Kanoi, host of The Exchange. Join me November 2nd at 9 a.m. as the candidates discuss their plans for New Hampshire's largest city. And send us your questions to exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, evolutions in manufacturing employment. As one writer put it, where once strong backs and hard work sufficed, today's manufacturing depends on smart minds and an agile workforce. This hour, we're looking at industry struggles to find those employees. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Where is New Hampshire's future manufacturing workforce going to come from? We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, questions, comments, and of course, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Christine Carr, Phil Prez-Bazuski, Sarah Colson, here's the big question that I want to hear from you on, and then we'll go to our listeners. And Sarah, to you first, there have been concerns that certain types of kids from certain racial groups or lower socioeconomic groups have been sort of encouraged by their teachers and guidance counselors to go into manufacturing, whereas the kids from, you know, a different class are sort of pushed to get that, you know, 4-year degree at UNH. And I just wonder how you go about this carefully, pushing a kid to do something that he or she might not really be suited for.
Right, absolutely. Now, there have been a lot of conversations about this when we were talking earlier about the cultural shift for parents. There's also a cultural shift that needs to happen academically in the school systems. And so I think that over the past couple of decades, there's really the gold standard has become 4-year college. The students are being encouraged to go to a 4-year college or what? There's not really an alternative for them in a lot of cases. Right now, the schools are being judged. The guidance counselors are being judged on the number of students that they're sending to a 4-year college.
Whether those kids end up being successful or not.
Correct. And if you look at the stats, it's something like half of the students are only about half are going to college in the first place. Of those, only about half actually make it all the way through.
Wow.
And so along the way, they're incurring all this debt. And especially for those that don't make it through for one reason or another, now they have an enormous amount of debt. They don't have a degree. And what do you do? And I think, you know, there's been this disconnect. You know, we are setting students up to go to a 4-year college without asking them, what do you want? What are your interests? Where do you want to go? And so the conversation has been shifting, I think, over the short period of time that I've been in this role. I'm seeing a lot of conversations that are happening around how do we identify what students are interested in and when do we do that? And so earlier when I mentioned, you know, just exposing students younger and younger to the types of opportunities, that's where businesses can really start engaging with schools. They can start getting in and doing career days and getting into classrooms and maybe sharing a little bit about what it means to be in manufacturing. The field trips, the tours, the job shadows, there are just a lot of different ways to engage with students. And the interesting piece of this then becomes, well, not every student is going to be in a manufacturing, not interested in that. That's not for everybody. But even if that student is exposed to it and decides this isn't for me, that's been a choice that has been helpful for them. That's an exposure to a career that now is helping lead them the correct direction for their own passions and for their lives.
It's tricky, isn't it, Christine? I mean, I'm putting myself in that guidance counselor's shoes. You don't want to say to one person because of the demographics that they present, you know, I think you're cut out for community college system. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I just wonder what your thoughts are around that.
Well, I think there are two aspects to that answer. The first one is guidance counselors, as we know them, at least in our generation, are not doing the same things that they were doing, I hate to say it, 25, 30 years ago for me anyways. But there's so much focus now and such a need for the counselors to spend time with young people on their own emotional, behavioral issues and so forth, that really dominates their time. And I'm not an educator, so I can't say how long this has been going on for, but it's happened gradually, I'm sure, over time. At the same time, there are other people who have specific roles. They were hired to do career counseling, and that is all they do. It's a matter of resources and funding. But I think also it goes beyond this, and my personal opinion is that it's becoming a situation where it's not really humanly scalable to ask guidance counselors to be all things to all kids.
They have so many kids per guidance
counselor. They have
counselor.
So much responsibility. Yeah. I mean, I think they continue to try, but I do believe that we need to find maybe a better solution for making sure that every child is touched somehow in some way with career messages, with thinking about what they want to do from a very early age. And I don't know if the system can actually support that idea or not.
Multiple career messages. And I wonder, it was interesting what Sarah said, Christine, that guidance counselors are often judged by how many kids they send to college, whether or not they are appropriately placed there. So today, college is seen as the gold standard. It's just tough, isn't it? It's tough to figure out how much you're skewing someone towards something that they're not really interested in, and how much you're showing them something that, you know, could be fantastic.
It is. I mean, we don't want our kids to be saddled with debt. At the same time, I think that there's a place in career education for young people to decide if they would like to get a job and work for a while and try out those skills, or if they want to take those skills and go into college. And I think if we can just do a little better job on the high school side, which is not to say that we're not doing great things, which I can talk about in a few minutes, but they might make better decisions about where they go to college and when they go to college.
Go ahead, Phil.
To your point about community college, since I work for that system, that's a great way to taste a part of the college life and career at a very, very low cost. If you look at the numbers, the cost to go to community college in New Hampshire is half what it costs to go to UNH. The bad news is New Hampshire has the highest tuition rate of any state in the union, so it's a relatively good thing there. But I'm a product of community college education, and I went on after that and went to a four-year school. But it helped me understand. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I know I didn't want to. I went, got out of high school and said, "Yeah, I really know what I want to do. But I got to get some more education. I know what it is." And my background originally was accounting, but so I went to a two-year school, and I said, "You know, this is not enough either." So I'm transferring. All my credits were transferred, by the way. So all that money that my parents spent was, and back then it was very, very cheap, was not lost. The investment was not lost. And there are a lot of students that get forced, and let's say force is the right word, but they get urged to go to college. It's not the right thing for them. They just can't handle it. They come out $35,000, $36,000 in debt. They're working at a retail job because they don't have the degree. Maybe they're working two retail jobs because they don't make enough, $8 or $9, $10 an hour to make a living out of it. So this is it's a really tough situation that
So you seem to be saying, Phil, you know, to my question of how careful do we need to be about pushing certain kids towards technical degrees and manufacturing? You're saying some kids are pushed towards four-year degrees in the other direction. So we need to watch out for both. Is that what you're?
I think so.
What you're going after there?
Yeah. It's not 4-year degrees, not for everybody, and neither is a 2-year. But I think one of the things that we're working on in the state is work-based learning projects. So we want every student to get exposed to some kind of work-based experience before they leave high school so that they can get a taste for what it is to work in a different environment.
Lots of listeners want to jump in on this question. We're asking, where are the manufacturing workers going to come from? Again, companies say they have great jobs, but not the skilled workers to fill them. So we're looking at that. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first to Concord, where Mohammed is calling in. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Good morning, Sarah. I would like to say, before 2 years or 3 years, the last 5 years ago, a lot of people arrived in New Hampshire under the refugee program from Syria, Iraq, Nepal, some other countries. And some people came engineering, like looks like chemical engineering, electrical engineering, or some people like a doctor or something. You know, the new people, when arrive, you don't know the system, you don't know anything. And go to work in the Walmart or other place and stick in this job. My opinion should be some office or some organization to just push him in the system, because ready to work, have a high certificate from other country. You know, the system here is different. Just need some help to push him. I think that's a good source to add something for New Hampshire here.
Mohammed, this is a great question. I'm so glad you called, because, Sarah, I did want to ask you about this. How much is the immigrant workforce seen as a potential talent pool. He mentioned refugee populations in Concord and Manchester, certainly, to a lesser extent, Laconia. And then there's refugees in Nashua and lots of immigrants. I wonder about that talent pool. Thank you, Mohammed.
Yeah, this is a timely question as well, because we actually are putting on a presentation at lunchtime today, a Lincoln Forum event, talking exactly about this. So veterans, immigrants, aging workforce, and adults with disabilities, and how to go about hiring in those populations and sort of what the barriers are and how do we remove those. So that this is a perfect question. There is absolutely an awareness that there are untapped resources currently in the state that we really need to be looking into. The hardest part, and I'm going to focus specifically on refugees, immigrants, and veteran populations, because there are certain skill sets that these populations have that are arriving here in the state, that are exiting the military and going back into civilian life, having had experiences that are valuable and in some cases have a credential. And we don't have a great way right now of capturing those experiences and giving them sort of credit for them. So there are a couple of different schools in the state that are trying right now to put together prior learning assessments so that we can really get a better sense of what those skills are and how they might translate into a degree, so that if you're trying to go into a certain line of work, that you will have the ability to do that. We don't have a great system, and I wish that I had a better answer for that. But that is absolutely something on the radar, and we are looking to try to see how we can better work with those populations.
Well, it's super interesting, and we'll put that information, if you would like, about that conversation that you're having just today.
Today,
so interesting.
Yes.
We can put that on our website, if
sure.
you'd like.
We can. I think that the last I heard, we had tapped out.
We filled the room.
It is.
Well, but here's the point that I've heard from a lot of people that, you know, you talked about and Mohammed talked about, and thank you again, Mohammed. You know, sometimes people have certain skills from their home country,
right.
but they're not applicable. So as he said, they end up working at Walmart, where
right.
they could have one of these, you know, well-paying
Absolutely.
Manufacturing jobs. I've heard from, you know, American, you know, people who were born here, American citizens, that sometimes they move in from another state and they have a hard time
sure.
pursuing what they did. In New Hampshire, I have a friend who's a pharmacist who had to take the whole
right.
test all over again, even though she'd been a pharmacist in California for many years. So
right.
there's like a certification bureaucracy that seems kind of stuck.
Right. Yes. And there are some programs that are in this state. One of them is My Turn, which is a program that partners with businesses with industry. So there's there's a business in the southern part of the state that has taken on a couple of rounds of training now. They've gone through, I think they're in the second, maybe even going into their third round.
Third cohort. Huh?
Third. Fantastic. And Phil can probably speak more to the details of this. But they're training individuals right on site at the plant. And so that they are, those students are then able to roll right into positions at the location.
Here we have Mohammed saying, we're here, we're ready, we've got skills. And you seem to be saying, Sarah, you know, we need to look at this. This is a great potential talent pool. And yet, you know, Phil, there are efforts in Washington to curb immigration. I wonder how manufacturers feel about this. You know, this sort of efforts on one hand to curb immigration, but then employers are saying, no, we need these people. They have talents. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce recently called for an extension of what's called temporary protected status for 300,000, what they called hardworking immigrants. So I just wonder about this push-pull here of this potential group of folks that could help New Hampshire manufacturers.
Well, just to get back to Mohammed's point, there are, you know, we've done a lot of research in this particular area in the sector partnerships, particularly manufacturing, but other sectors as well. And there are roughly 3,000 immigrant and refugees between Nashua, Manchester, and Concord. We know that population exists. We are working with companies like Accenture to try and develop programs and get federal grants to get them trained. There are lots of colleges that will do free English as second language programs so they can get across the language barrier. So there's lots of things going on to address the immigrant community. Not fast enough. Perhaps, but they are. It's not an unknown factor. We are definitely focused on that. I can't address with the federal government to deal with what they want to do with immigration and all stuff, but I can tell you there. And Mohammed's 100% correct. There are people with advanced degrees or bachelor's degrees that are driving cabs, or doing jobs that are way below their capabilities. They're underemployed. They might be working two or three jobs to get by because they got a family to feed. So it's definitely a situation we are aware of and we're trying to address.
Well, Mohammed, again, thank you so much. And let's go to Peter in Barrington. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I'm the director of talent development at a company called TurboCam out of Barrington. And we've been challenged with the hiring. The employment rate is really low in New Hampshire. It's really considered at full employment when you get below 3%. But we've just had to get creative in how we have advertised for positions. We've done a lot more through social media to attract folks. But we've really found a somewhat of a sweet spot with, you know, there's younger folks who have been out of high school for a couple of years, but also there's this whole group of folks who may be looking to start a second career. So they've been in the workforce for a while. Whatever industry they were in is sort of winding down or whatever it may be. And we've found that, you know, as long as they have an aptitude, some mechanical ability, we can train almost anybody in what we do. And we've actually created a whole training program. We have a machine operator training program, for example, where we put people through a 6-week training that's paid, and they have a job. They're hired, but they first go through 6 weeks of training, and then they're deployed into a position as a machine operator.
So what does TurboCam do, Peter? That sounds really, that's a really cool name.
Sure. We're an engineering solutions and manufacturer. We cater to the aerospace and automotive industries, primarily also industrial. So we basically specialize in 5-axis machining, which is really specialized manufacturing. But we have a lot of machine operator entry level roles, and those positions get on a track to get into becoming a full machinist and then moving up through our, you know, machinist 1 through 3 series.
Okay.
But there's also branches off of that, quality positions, inspector and so forth, operations roles. So there's a variety of roles that people can get into just by coming in the door as an entry-level machine operator, where they're, you know, operating 4 or 5 machines at a time. They're running a cell, basically.
So, Peter,
there is a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, and it kind of gets to what Phil said before, and I'm going to ask you, Christine, what you think. You know, he seems to be telling people, Peter in Barrington, you're not going to be standing at the same machine for 30 years. So go ahead. I'd love your thoughts, Christine.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a very exciting career if you'd like to go into manufacturing. There's so many different paths that you can take. When I look at some of the schools that exist across the state, we have centers in Wolfboro and North Conway, Portsmouth, Exeter, really all across the state that have these very interesting opportunities for students to learn and immediately connect with employers. One of the things that I didn't mention before is that you can actually earn we have something called dual enrollment where you take classes and you can earn credit from community colleges. So there are several programs throughout the state that provide that option for kids. Also, just as an example, amazing program. Well, we have so many. We probably don't have enough time to talk about it today. But in North Conway, as an example, we have a partnership with NASA. And those kids are actually working on parts. They are manufacturing parts for NASA. They were honored last year and had a trip to Houston. And you know, this is the kind of exposure that kids really need. We actually go beyond engagement. One of our directors is integrated to the system. You know, she served on the Governor's Manufacturing Council. So we really are doing a lot of things to stay connected here.
Okay, well, Peter, thank you for the call. And lots of emails that I want to share with you after a break, as well as some calls. I've got someone who's concerned about the opioid crisis and whether that has reduced the number of qualified workers for these manufacturing jobs. So we'll talk about that in just a moment and take a lot more of your questions and comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire manufacturing. Lots of jobs, but not enough workers. We're looking at manufacturing's struggles to find the right employees. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. As we look at this question, where is New Hampshire's future manufacturing workforce going to come from? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Here's an email that came in earlier from Katrina in Concord. She says, I think that the typical employee for these types of businesses is a young man. Unfortunately, a lot of young men in New Hampshire are tied up in the drug epidemic. I think you'll find that's where a lot of the potential employees have disappeared to. Katrina, thank you so much for this. This is a really important point. And Sarah, I know the BIA's been concerned.
We are absolutely concerned. The opioid crisis has affected the ability to employ for many of our manufacturers. When I have conversations with manufacturers about their hiring practices, they are having difficulty getting employees, potential employees, to pass a drug test. You know, it's something that has it has multiple layers, though. It's not just those employees who are struggling themselves. It's also employees who have family members who are struggling, have an inability to get to work because they're dealing with things on the home front, an inability to just be there on a consistent basis. And as we know in manufacturing, it's very important. There's not a lot of flexibility. It's not like you can take your computer home and work from home if there's something going on the home front. You really have to be there, and you have to be there for a set period of time. So,
right. You have to run the equipment
exactly
properly so that the job can be done. Yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
And let's say you have a spouse who's struggling with addiction, and you have to get your kids to school on time. If your shift starts at 7 a.m. and there's nobody bringing the kids to school, again, there's another barrier, and that's a barrier to employment. And so there are different ways in which it's affecting the workforce right now. You know, I'm not personally involved through the BIA in this type of work. I know through the partnership with the Charitable Foundation, they're putting a lot of money. I think they just had another, they announced just recently, a few weeks ago, another $3 million that will be going towards this type of work. And with their New Hampshire Tomorrow initiative, they have the four pillars, and substance abuse and support is one of them. So, you know, that's that connection that I have with the Charitable Foundation is helpful, and that they're doing a lot of this work and really fantastic work throughout the state to try to help with this. But it definitely, it does affect our workforce.
Well, listening to you, Sarah, Phil, I'm getting a sense of just how wide this is. It isn't just the employee who's struggling with drug addiction, who shows up and, you know, can't work properly, but also someone who is trying to cover for a family member who's struggling with addiction. I'm struck by what you say, Sarah.
Environment's a safety problem, too. So you don't want someone
right.
who can't operate a machine to hurt other people as well as themselves. But just to get back to the question that was offered, it started out with the term that a man.
A young man,
this
yes.
is, today's, you know, my favorite line is brains over brawn. So,
well, I wanted to ask you guys about that. Yeah, so go ahead.
Positions within the manufacturing world that didn't exist before because you had to be Joe Atlas to lift 80 pounds and all that stuff. But the jobs have changed so much because the technology has allowed that there are fabulous opportunities for females. And that's another target audience that we have in our group is, you know, women. And how do we totally take away some of the barriers that maybe they have to deal with because maybe they're a stay-at-home mom or whatever the case may be? So I wouldn't just say it's a man's world.
Well, and I'm glad you said that because I did want to pull out that comment from Katrina's email and ask you, Christine, what efforts manufacturers are making to reach out to women who may think, this isn't really for me, it's a guy's world.
I don't know if I can speak on behalf of manufacturers, but I can tell you what the schools are doing for sure.
And speaking as a woman who's worked in manufacturing yourself.
Well, yeah, for sure. Of course, it was male-dominated when I was in the business, too, and it probably still is. But the point is now is the kind of jobs that are available in manufacturing are much broader, so there are more places where women can step in than probably there were 25, 30 years ago. But for CTE's part, it's funny. This is a great story. I was up visiting the Wolfboro Center, and Bruce Farr, the director there, was showing me his manufacturing program. And I'm looking around. And I'm seeing all these young people walking around. I don't see, you know, too many women. I'm just wondering what the mix is. And I turned around for a moment and came back, and there was this young woman standing there. She was about 17. And I said, oh, I said, hi. I said, what's your name? She said, oh, my name's Kayla. I said, well, what are you studying here, Kayla? She says, I'm studying welding, and I'm in my second year, and I love it, and I'm going on to community college, and I'm going to get into manufacturing. And I turned around for a second to take a note on my pad. When I turned back around, there were two of them. I said, who are you? She says, I'm Kaylee. I said, Kayla and Kaylee, are you guys sisters? Twin sisters studying welding and manufacturing. And one of them says, well, I'm actually an artist and a sculptor. And I was drawn to working with metals. And I have been finding a lot of kids really, really are drawn to welding. I mean, this is, you know, it involves fire and metals. It's exciting. It's a way to kind of really draw kids in and also connects deeply to the maker movement, which is really hot right now.
Well, and we have an email about the maker movement. So let's talk about that because some people listening may go, maker movement, what's that? This is from Bryant, who says, lots of the discussion seems to just assume school paths are either academic or manufacturing. Four-year college students, Bryant says, need to be exposed in school how to make things. The maker movement, Bryant says, is doing this, but we need to shift the mindset of parents of college-bound students because the heads of companies and nascent entrepreneurs will need to deeply understand manufacturing to succeed in the 21st century. So go ahead, Christine. Bryant seems to be folding into exactly what you were just saying.
Well, for sure. Makerspaces, I think, might be misunderstood unless you have visited one. Because it's not just a place where you can go and sew and create and draw and paint, which are all beautiful things and all connect to technical areas later. But it also includes things such as 3D printing and laser cutting. And 3D printing, of course, is the advent of additive manufacturing just in the last 10 years has exploded. And so there's a big, I guess, just a lack of awareness about what makerspaces can do for kids because it really exposes them to areas of technology and manufacturing that they never considered before that wouldn't be in the mainstream. So for sure, our kids love going to those spaces. We have a few of them actually in the CTE network as well.
Well, thank you for the email, Bryant. And here's another one from Ginny who says, I'm an advocate for integrative education. Giving the student an opportunity to understand the interconnectedness among skills can open minds to choices they didn't even know existed. It also gives parents and teachers insight into what turns a child on to learning. Ginny says, when I was teaching on the college level, I always encouraged my first year students to take all their gen eds early on because they were exposed to subjects that they might not have chosen on their own. So again, there's Ginny advocating for an integrated approach. I wonder what you think about that, Sarah.
Oh, I have some great thoughts on this one. There have been a lot of great conversations that I've been having with not only manufacturers, but others in technology. These two kind of go hand in hand. As a lot of people are probably aware, we have the Army program that's coming into Manchester, the southern part of the state. There's a lot of biotechnology that's happening right now.
Right. And where are those workers going to come
exactly.
from?
Exactly. Well, that's a whole other question, right? But there is a lot of growth right now and a lot of opportunity. And what I'm hearing a lot of is, and of course, this is sort of throughout every industry, but primarily in manufacturing and engineering, we don't really know in technology. We don't know where the jobs of the future are, what they're going to look like, what will they be. And so employers are looking for flexibility. And so students who really have the ability to work well in a lot of different fields and can be creative moving forward because we don't really know what the jobs will be. So when we talk about the integration here, you know, it's critical that our students are being kind of cross-trained in a lot of different areas and have that ability to shift from one topic to the next or one, you know, have interests in a lot of different areas and some overlap of skills there. And to tie into that as well, I mean, one piece, and this is kind of circling back to an earlier part of the conversation, but I'm just going to throw it out there because it seems to fit. When we talk about the training that goes on and how we don't really know what the skills of the future are, employers now are saying, if I have an employee who comes to me with the critical soft skills, those basic, you know, communication, ability to work on a team, basic math, reading skills, that we can train. And so, you know, when we talk about the high amount of debt that can be incurred, employers right now, manufacturing employers, are very willing to take on some of that debt for students. And so you can go into an entry-level position and that you know, maybe go through a six-week boot camp, get on the floor working and have a career pathway set up for you where along the way at all of these integral turning points, the employer will really help you get to that next step.
So I have heard a lot about what you just said, Sarah, that employers, manufacturing employers, say they want soft skills. People can communicate, people can work in teams. But we've had so much emphasis in our education system in recent years on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. STEM. Every time you open the newspaper, right. Go to a back to school night, whatever. So mm-hmm. are we now, you know, was that a mistake? Did we go overboard on that STEM, and now you're not seeing the soft skills?
Right. Well, you know what? I don't think that those two, I think they're almost separate issues. I don't think that we went overboard with STEM. I think that I'm actually talking as a former mathematician, so that was my background.
Full disclosure.
I think that it's really critical that especially women, young girls, are exposed to that. And I think that's some place that we've fallen short in the past with, you know, making it seem as though STEM fields were really for men. And manufacturing falls under this as well. And so that, again, as we were talking about just a few minutes ago. But I think that even though we're putting more focus on STEM, and I think that's a very important thing, that alongside that, somewhere, those critical soft skills need to be taught, and they're not really being taught. And as our culture has changed a little bit, you know, students aren't getting out and getting that first job in high school anymore. Sometimes they're not getting their first job till they're out of college. And so some of those soft skills that may have been taught in a working environment at age 15, 16 years old, they're just not happening now. And so we have the soft skills that are not embedded in our curriculum. They've never probably been embedded in the curriculum in any meaningful way, that really do need to be taught somewhere. And who does that?
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. And Victoria is calling from Hopkinton. Hi, Victoria. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Victoria.
So my question is... I am a Lego robotics coach. I'm involved in the Girl Scouts. And our Lego robotics team is girls that are ages 11 and 12. We have an all-girl team. My question is, how can we get young girls more interested in technology, manufacturing, engineering? Because I'm finding that's really a challenge. This year, where our team has, I think, 4 or 5 members. In the past, our teams have been bigger, but it seems like girls, young girls, it's hard to get them interested in science and technology. Once they are interested, they do a fabulous job. Our team actually won first place last year for our project. So how can we encourage young girls to be more interested in this?
Okay. Thanks for the call, Victoria. Very interesting. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, the answer there is we have to keep talking to them, and we have to talk to all of them. So we really have to improve our outreach even more than what we've done, and we have to get them earlier. And we have to find ways to get them excited and interested and then keep them interested. It's almost like, I think from my point of view, like a nurturing campaign. It's going to involve so many tools that kids can relate to. It's got to be all those things, social media, Instagram, Facebook. We have to relate to kids where they're at, you know, where they live.
Yeah. Well, it gets back to our earlier conversation about, you know, bringing in groups that aren't as heavily represented in manufacturing, immigrants, women. What about, Phil, older Granite Staters? We hear time and time again that the Granite State is an aging population. How much do you see manufacturers reaching out to that group of folks who maybe don't want to spend, you know, 8 hours a day on the floor, but maybe they could spend 4 hours a day on the floor?
That's a great point, because one of the exacerbating factors that we deal with in not just manufacturing, but particularly manufacturing, is that we're aging out. The average age of a manufacturing employee is like 55 years old, 56 years old. And a lot of those people who probably wanted to retire couldn't, because the stock market took a little dive back in 2007, 2008, and wiped out 40% of their savings. So there's a lot of people working beyond their retirement age. But if you talk to any of the manufacturers in the state of any size, they'll tell you that within the next 5 to 7 years, I'm going to lose about 20% of my workforce because they're going to retire.
20%? That's huge.
Yeah. And these are the people who know the most. So
right. It's
very important to bring that next generation in so they can be mentored by these folks before they do decide to punch out for good, so to speak. But there are a lot of companies are doing programs like you just suggested, Lauren, where they would ask a retiree to come back and work part-time. You get the skills that you've acquired over the 30 years you work for us. Can you be a mentor for our next round of employees? It's not as heavy lifting as a full-time job. They probably don't need the money. They're not doing it because, you know, they probably got retirement already figured out. But companies are looking at that as an option to extend the skills that they have in place today and allow them to buy a year or 2 or 3 years to train that next level, next generation of workers.
Sure. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, it is a real problem. And I think, you know, part of that, too, what we're concerned about anyways in our generation is how are we going to get these young people to communicate and interact and interface the way that we learned and the way that, that we know how to do? And what Sarah was saying before about the whole soft skills piece, I wanted to kind of chime in on that. I just had the opportunity to drive around the state for the last, I guess, 8 weeks, visiting about a dozen different schools and meeting with all of these teachers. There's 400 teachers, 10,000 students, and 27 directors in the system. So it's a big community. And whenever I could, I would talk with the kids. And one thing I noticed about the CTE kids is that they stand up straight, they look you in the eye, they're fairly well spoken, they seem calm. And I really love that. It's you know, to me, it's very inspiring what's happening here. And I think what that speaks to is they've found a place that feels comfortable to them. And that's where the soft skills come in. The interesting thing is I am only beginning to be exposed to the soft skills programs that are developed in the system. But what I see more anecdotally is the way soft skills evolve as part of the experience of being in CTE. So if you work in a shop, you learn how to interact with your fellow teammates. You have a job every day. You know how to organize your thinking. You learn how to plan. You learn how to communicate, how to be a team player. And then you find what you're good at and you develop confidence. So those are all related to things in the soft skills category.
So CTE, again, just in case folks didn't catch it the first time we talked about
it. Yeah, for parents that are listening, those are your career and technical education schools that are a subset of the 80 high schools in the system, although many of those other schools who are not necessarily CTE schools do provide a number of related career and tech ed programming as well. But if you are interested in this, you can go to our website, which is nh-cte.org, and we can direct you to a center from there.
And if you're driving down the highway and didn't catch that, we've got lots of resources on our own website, nhpr.org/exchange. So we'll put links up to a lot of the programs and so forth that we've talked about today. Real quick to you, Sarah, if I called you back in a year and said, come on, let's talk about this, what would we be talking about a year from now?
Oh, gosh. Well, hopefully I'll have some great examples of how to connect with local businesses with educators, and hopefully we've made some progress towards our goal of reaching 65% of our state being highly skilled or trained by 2025.
All right. And we'll put a link to that talk that you guys are doing today, even though you know Perfect. It's maxed out. But if folks want to learn a little more about that, we can put that on our website as well. All of you, thank you very much. Phil, it was good to meet you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Phil Presbyszewski. He's Workforce Solutions Project Director for the Community College System of New Hampshire. Sarah, good to meet you. Thank you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you.
Sarah Colson, Director of Workforce Development at the New Hampshire BIA. And Christine Carr, thank you also for your time.
Thank you so much.
Christine Carr, Executive Director for the New Hampshire Career and Technical Educators Association. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.